Through the centuries, a major argument against atheism was that without God giving us a moral framework for action, people would inevitably act unethically. Now, I have not found that to be valid. As you use, we do not question that one can be good without God, developing our own moral system. In fact, whether or not we believe in God, we believe that humans created morality. We know that ethical and moral codes from the ancient Sumerian Ur-Nammu code and Hammurabi's code through modern utilitarianism to postmodern relativism, all codes of ethics, morality, and goodness come from human beings, not from one God or another. Codes that have a godly imprimatur are simply rules that some humans believe gods have given them. Now, that's not a controversial statement here in this congregation, I don't think. Yet many people in our nation would disagree with it. They believe that morality, ethics, even laws come from God or from nature. Morality is part of the fundamental differences that exist in our country. And we UUs believe in morality and ethics, just not the same morality and ethics that some others do. We take being good seriously. One 19th century Unitarian was quoted as saying, "I spell my God with two O's, and my devil without a D." And when the doctrine of universalism showed up, the idea of universal salvation, that everyone would be reunited with God, some argued against it, claiming that without the threat of hell, people would not behave themselves. Universalists scoffed. If you take morality seriously, you don't need threats. And if you really think about it, the threat of hell hasn't done a lot to keep people in line. Plenty of true believers in hell act in morally reprehensible ways. And many people have left religious traditions because of what they summarize as hypocrisy, that is, that people don't act as they say people ought to act. The problem is, of course, they can't help it. They're people. They are going to act in ways that are sometimes inconsistent with what they say or their moral values. That's what we do. We're people. We UUs don't really have a doctrine of sin, but we know instinctively that being good is not as easy as we wish it were. As Unitarian Universalists, our focus in religion is often on freedom. We see ourselves as having a free faith, one that does not require us to utter creeds we do not believe or follow rules that we question. There's a difference, though, between being free and being libertine. In fact, our fourth principle specifies our support for a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And that's what is meant by it matters what we believe. We are clear that we need to choose on the basis of reason, experience, learning from others, whatever our sources, whatever sources we embrace, we have to choose what we believe. And I want to say that's different than believe whatever you want. There are beliefs that are not in alignment with Unitarian Universalism. Beliefs that do not consider the welfare of others, like racism, and those that ignore factual information, like opposition to evolution, don't fit in with Unitarian Universalism. I heard Bill Sinkford, a former president of the UUA, say, "We don't believe whatever we want. We believe what we are compelled to believe." Our search for truth has to be responsible as well as free. Responsible to be grounded in reality and to embrace all of humanity. And how much more true is that of the way we live our lives? We need to live not only free lives, but also responsible lives. We have an obligation as humans in community with one another to do more than act freely, exercising our agency, we also have an obligation to act responsibly. So this morning, I want to spend a little time on that responsible piece, the part that pulls us toward an ethic, a set of moral principles by which we can live freely. Howard Thurman, in his reflection, Freedom is a Discipline, writes that central to our individual freedom is, and I quote, a principle of orderedness, which becomes a guide for behavior and action. Under such circumstances, goals may be changed deliberately, and the sense of random, pointless living is removed. So said Thurman. He was a prominent African-American religious leader in the middle of the last century, and his work balanced contemplation and action. He was thoroughly committed to the role of meditation and prayer, and people called him a mystic. But he was also active in the civil rights movement. Thurman contended that life without some principle of orderedness, a way of thinking in a systematic way about who we are and what we want, without that, life will be pointless and random. So that means we have to consider our actions, contemplate the ideas that underlie those actions, and determine, are my actions consistent with what I believe? Are my actions consistent instead with ideas that I thought I had tossed away that still somehow inform how I behave? Do I find myself reacting in ways that are inconsistent with the values and principles I support? Now, how many times, those of you who are parents, have you wondered where particular words came from that you heard yourself saying to your children, realizing that you learned them from your parent and thought you had set them aside? It happens. As you use, we tend to focus on our agency, on our ability to act, to do, and forget that sometimes our actions have been shaped by other things, by ideas we thought we had left behind, by things that we learned in a different setting, beliefs that we have not thoroughly reflected on to see whether or not we agree with them. My grandfather used to say about my grandmother that she said everything she thought, she just didn't think everything she said. And in a similar way, we sometimes act before thinking in such a way that what we believe receives short shrift in how we actually are acting. And many of us who grew up outside of Unitarian Universalism have tried to set aside sets of moral principles that were given to us by family or religion. For example, we don't find homosexuality ethically objectionable. We're not keen on obedience as a virtue. We reject traditional sex roles. Yet the remnants of those ways of thinking have not broken their hold on us. We need the kind of contemplation and reflection about our actions, the discipline of freedom that Thurman talks about. And this is no easy task. Life is incredibly messy. And in living, we harm as well as help others, even when we are trying. Have you ever known anyone who seems to be trying too hard to live their values? I knew a woman who used to rewrite all the fairy tales so her children wouldn't be exposed to violence or traditional sex roles. And her kids weren't into the double digits before they were rolling their eyes at her efforts. They already knew life was more complicated than what their mother tried to present to them. And few of us are that rigorous in our living, and we make mistakes, sometimes horrible mistakes, usually not intentionally. We have difficult choices to make. So that was demonstrated by the trolley question that Chidi presented in the Good Place video we saw, a classic test of utilitarianism. In the trolley question, no matter what you do, someone dies. Doing harm is unavoidable. And real life is so much messier. We don't usually know if there's someone else on the other track or where the lever is to redirect the train. The clear cause and effect of the trolley question makes utilitarianism workable. We can clearly see the effect of our action. But life is more complicated, and we usually don't have the opportunity to debate it before we can act. And the idea of good intentions. Good intentions have received increasing scrutiny, particularly as we work to deconstruct racism. We've learned good intentions do not protect from having a harmful effect. I didn't mean to hurt you doesn't excuse harm that is created. And we know this from interactions with our families and friends and colleagues. People can feel insulted or snubbed when someone was careless or joking or overreacted or taken the wrong way. It's easy. It happens all the time. And we quickly get defensive. I didn't mean that. I was only trying to help. You're being too sensitive. And it's even more loaded when that impact has tones of racism, sexism, ableism, or homophobia. The hurts are real even when they're not intended as hurts, and they're ethical breaches. What's more, the person who has done the hurt does not matter in this situation as much as the person who has been hurt. Or as UU Minister Ashley Horan puts it, it matters more that your foot hurts than that I didn't mean to step on it. And that leads directly to the need to take responsibility for our actions. We have agency, yes, we can move freely. If we are to be responsible, though, we need to accept the consequences of what we've done. As part of this, we have to realize that all human beings have agency, and some have more agency than others. That's hard for us sometimes. I think, for example, of people in prison. The system has seized much of their agency. Still, there are decisions they can make. People in poverty have fewer choices than people who have resources. Still, there are some. And one of the reasons that I feel so strongly about using my own agency in larger ways is because I have so much agency, so much freedom, so much privilege. I realized this when I was coming out in West Virginia in the 1980s. I saw other people who had so much more to lose, that they were losing their families, their children, their jobs. And I felt I had to take more risk to make change, to confront systems that were wrong, because I had less to lose. And we're always going to be surrounded by those corrupt systems. And another complication in doing good is the conflict between morality and convention. That is, the unspoken social norms we're expected to live by. In this culture, if you live by social norms, a regular life, you are probably violating at least a little some of your moral values. As Unitarian Universalists or as UU sympathizers. I heard a UU minister tell a story of overhearing a conversation about a group among a group of women at lunch, and he heard them mention Unitarian, so he couldn't help but eavesdrop. Well, he must have been eavesdropping to have heard the word, right? Oh, well, anyway. What do Unitarians believe in? Asked one of them. Recycling, said another. Yes, we have strong environmental values, yet we drive cars that burn fossil fuels. And even if you're using an electric car, you're getting energy somewhere, and I doubt it all comes from solar and wind. I'm sorry. At least in Kansas, you're probably getting some of it from coal if you're using electricity. Maybe you spend longer in the shower than necessary, wasting precious water resources, or use the plastic bags they give you at the store, or shop at places you're morally opposed to, or cringe at how much plastic packaging you go through, or gasp, don't actually recycle. I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad or guilty. I do these things all the time. We live in a world where we're at least expected, if not required, to behave in ways that are harmful to the earth. I have a Catholic friend, Bob, who does his best to live a minimalist life in terms of contributing to environmental harm. He redid his house to maximize sustainable values, so it's you know, got this installation that's amazing. He grows a lot of his own food. He gets most of the rest from local farmers. He pays attention to environmental issues in everything he does. In the summer, he cooks outside to avoid heating up the house because he avoids air conditioning. His priest, and this is why it's relevant that he's Catholic, his priest finally told him to quit confessing environmental sins. Even Bob cannot escape the conventional cultural challenges, so I know I'm not going to. At the same time, it's important for me to realize I'm making a choice when I drive somewhere that I could bike or walk, or when I buy unnecessary packaging, because it pushes me toward more frequent, better decisions and helps me know how I'd like to address the larger conventions that often seem to have me trapped. And some of the conventions are more than custom. Some of them are actual laws. We live in a society whose laws, as well as customs, all created by human beings, right? They're soaked in assumptions that contradict our values. What are we to make of a country that can legally justify what we're doing on the southern border? What are we to make of a country that can legally justify the disproportionate prosecution of people of color in our justice system? Or the imbalance of our tax system? Or any number of other laws that might not pass moral muster? So realizing that, we as UUs work for changing the laws and may decide on tactics such as civil disobedience, breaking laws, to demonstrate their injustice. Most of the time, though, we live with them, and sometimes we even cooperate with them. We are only human. And life goes better if we work inside, or smoother, if we work inside the rules we are given. Or so said Scottish philosopher and economist Adam Smith in The Theory of Moral Sentiments in 1759. He wrote, "Without this sacred regard to general rules, there is no man whose conduct could be depended upon. It is which constitutes the most essential difference between a man of principle and honor and a worthless fellow. For not at least of the advantages of our acting according to commonly accepted moral rules is that our actions are predictable by others, and the actions of others are predictable by us, with the result that we are all better to cooperate with each other in helping each other to pursue our individual ends." So Adams is arguing that we have these rules, we have these laws, so that we have a predictable, orderly society. And that ultimately, everyone will do better that way. And that's the very reason that disruption can work as a tactic. Strikes work because people don't get the goods and services they usually do smoothly. Blocking traffic, disrupting legislative sessions and sit-ins draw attention to issues that most people find easy to ignore. And it feels weird to block traffic. But I was amazed to learn through the Poor People's Campaign how easy it is. If you're organized, if you have a group of people and you just go out and block the street, people stop. Now, that's a departure from Adam Smith's predictable way that men of principle work or act. Sometimes our principles, though, outweigh our laws. And at the same time, I feel the need to take these steps over the line quite seriously, even when done with a lighthearted spirit. So we need to get clear on when breaking laws and even conventions is merited and when it's not. And I can't answer that question for you any more than I can answer the question of what you should think about God. Well, in case I haven't complicated our ethical decision-making enough yet, I'll return to the good place from which we saw the video clip earlier. How many of you have ever watched that show? Okay. I have a couple spoilers in here, but really, the show's worth watching for its reflections on ethics, even if you already know some of the plot lines. I've warned you, though, if you want to stop listening for a few minutes for spoilers. The premise is that a demon, Michael, if you didn't figure out who the demon was in the lesson, he's played by Ted Danson, the one who figured out how to kill all the people on the tracks. So anyway, the premise is that Michael has set up a fake heaven, the good place, to torture dead human beings in creative ways. And eventually the tortured human beings figure it out, and working with the demon Michael, they even figure out that no one is getting into the real good place. They haven't in centuries because the accounting system makes it impossible. In short, you can't be good enough. Now, in traditional theology, we might call that original sin, the idea that we all have corruptibility built in. And our Unitarian forebears hated this idea, preferring to focus on the perfectibility of human beings, that is, our agency and ability to make choices to do better. And that's all well and good. Yet still somehow an incomplete picture. The focus on the goodness of humankind has left us in a situation where we can get awfully worked up and self-righteous about all the things that are wrong in the world, while seeing ourselves as the people perfectible enough to fix it all. And I'm thankful to UU Minister Nancy McDonald Ladd for some of these insights. She asks, what will it take for the utopian dreamers in today's liberal churches to actually listen to the voices we are accustomed to bellowing over? We have to know at a deep level that we are as apt as anyone else to make errors of judgment and to fail at our best efforts, and to miss something important as we weigh all the complicating factors. We may not need a theology of sin, but it might not hurt to keep in mind Francis Spufford's definition of sin. And I'm not going to use his exact words because I don't think it's appropriate from the pulpit. Sin, he says, is the human propensity to muck things up. So here is perhaps our most difficult call. After we do the reflection, consider our beliefs and how to live more and more in line with them, after we consider impact as well as intent, after we weigh law and convention, there's one more thing, and it may be the hardest of all. And it may actually be the first thing before all the rest of them. Humility. UU minister Paige Getty puts it this way: as responsible religious seekers, we recognize that we are privileged to be free, to have resources to pursue life beyond mere survival, to continually search for truth and meaning, to exist beyond bonds of dogma and oppression, and to wrestle freely with truth and meaning as they evolve. This privilege calls us not to be isolated and self-centered, believing that our single perspective trumps all others, but rather to be humble, to be open to the great mysteries of truth and meaning that life offers. And those mysteries may speak to us through our intuition and experience, but also through tradition, community, conflict, nature, and relationships. Paige reminds us of the need for humility. But she reminds us of another need, too, the need to connect beyond ourselves. The call away from isolation and self-centeredness. The call to love. And this call is not one that's only for designated individuals like leaders or ministers. The call to love is to everyone. Unitarianism reminds us that we have choice and agency, and universalism reminds us that we are all mixed up in this together and that love triumphs even over hell. So how can we be, in the words of the reading offered earlier today, convicted of universalism? Yes, supporting a UU church is one element of proof, as the reading said, but that's not enough. Universalism, remember, is one of the two direct predecessors to Unitarian Universalism. The conviction of early universalists was that God was so good and so loving that no one would end up in hell. And I always tell people that the answer for a universalist when anyone says you're going to hell is simple. I can't go to hell because I don't believe in it. It's an answer simple enough for a child and complex enough for a theologian. Now, the Unitarian side of our history would urge us that we need to become more like God. That means, then, that we, too, need to not condemn people to hell. Now, I don't know about you, but there have been times this week, for sure, and other weeks, when there have been certain people that I have been ready to consign to hell. No one here, for sure. But people who spew hatred and denigrate others, that is inconsistent with my beliefs. That is, it's inconsistent to spew hatred and denigrate others, but it's also inconsistent with my belief to say they should go to hell. My own thoughts become inconsistent with my beliefs. Meeting hate with hate is not the universalist way. Alas. Let me share a brief contemplation from white anti-racism activist Laura Brewer. Radical revolutionary love is the antidote to hate. So I invite you to contemplate these questions. What is my practice of radical love right now? For myself and for others. Is my practice of love so clear and strong that I can define it? That others can feel it? That I know exactly what it is? That I'm creating it with intention? Am I purposefully wielding my love as a force for justice? How? And who have I asked to hold me accountable? You cannot force their hate to change. And meeting hate with hate, separation, hostility, weaponized judgment will not work. Let it sharpen your blade of active, radical love instead. So to sum up, I believe that Unitarian Universalism calls us to four things ethically: to acknowledge our agency, to take responsibility for our actions, to do that with humility, and to practice radical, revolutionary, inclusive, universalist love. We have a few minutes for responses, reactions, questions. I take it there's some agreement with something I said.
Actually, I'm not going to say anything of importance. I'm just going to say the demon had a neat response. Oh, my God, I'm still laughing. Good job, you got us all.
Well, one thing you can say for Michael is he's consistent with his beliefs. I thought I saw some other hands. Yeah.
From the very beginning to the very end of this talk, I had to be thinking of, lately I have been wearing my respect others buttons a lot, and it's become kind of the byword, the thing that I'm trying to live up to in my life. And my daughter was just in town. I was in her hotel lobby saying goodnight to her and gave her a hug the other evening. And someone I didn't know, someone that worked at the hotel, basically said, "Oh, can I have a hug?" All right. I don't know how many other people feel this way, but this was a personal moment for me, and this was someone I didn't know that was like inserting themselves into my personal goodnight to my daughter. And I just automatically, without thinking, I said, "You're not my daughter." And they were taken aback by that. I felt that, you know, and now I feel bad because I feel as though I didn't respect them in some way. But I also feel that they didn't respect me in some way. So.
Life is messy and complicated.
Yeah, very messy. My name's Renee. That's important for this. But when around the ages 12 to 15, every year I'd write a new copy of what I called the Renesian Manifesto, which is supposed to be like a total description of everything that I believed and how all the different systems and stuff work together. And I stopped doing that at some point because I realized that it was an impossible task and it was really demanding. But, you know, lately I've been thinking more and more, it'd be fun to at least try, you know, and I kind of think that kids have that courage to try when a lot of times as adults we're so scared of what's going to come out that we don't try.
Yeah, you were writing a systematic theology.
just response. I'm weird, though. If someone says, "Can I have a hug?" No matter what, I say, "I give them a hug." But that's just me. But even if they're kind of weird, I do give them a hug because everybody needs a hug. I got a shirt that has a girl on it with his little doggy outfit saying, "Free hugs." So everybody gets a hug if you want one. Thank you.
Susan Adamchak. I find myself wondering if Rob made a number of changes to the program this week, reflecting this week's events. The music in particular seemed to speak to our need to speak out for what is happening in our country right now. I found, as the child of an immigrant family, I found the remarks this week to just be reprehensible. Someone pointed out that the sole woman who was actually an immigrant has been in this country longer than Mrs. Trump, and I don't hear any calls for her to be sent back to Slovenia. I know we're not supposed to be particularly political in our remarks, but I found this week very, very, very trying.
I think that we all did. Oh, no, it's a philosophy professor.
I will not get overly detailed in my analysis of the ethics presented here at all. But mostly because, especially at the end, sort of this hits home to what I think. Yes, we can discuss ethical principles and we can discuss, you know, the trolley cases, and what do we do to save people, and how much do we respect individual freedom and autonomy versus trying to do good? But in the end, I think one of the most important things is empathy and love, right? And extending this as far as possible, and treating as many, trying to get into as many people's heads, thinking about what they're going through, and using that in your decision making and how you approach the world. It is hard. I mean, and I find it hard. It's easy to love and empathize with people who you know and who are close to you if they're in a tough spot, but sort of extend that out just a little bit to people you don't know that well, and it's very hard. And extend it out to people who don't look the same as you or don't act the same as you or don't come from the same place, even harder, right? So I do think, you know, a personal responsibility is to try to, in I think Carol Gilligan's way, I think is what she said, extend the circles of love and empathy out, right, as far as you can. But I got to say, I struggle, especially applying it to people who are pretty vile, right? And especially if they're in positions of leadership. And I just don't know what the right thing to do there is, because at some point, I get it's not consistent with what you're saying. Man, that's hard. And I don't even know if it's right at some point, you know?
Yeah, I heard on the radio this thing about the doctor who did the anesthetic to Adolf Eichmann to get him out of the country, and he never felt entirely good about doing that, because he was going against some of his principles, really. But it was Adolf Eichmann. But at the same time, I think I'd rather have somebody doing it who feels conflicted about it in that way than someone who is... Yeah.
I believe early on in your talk, you were talking about people in leadership positions acting not necessarily morally. And... if we have time, I wouldn't mind you addressing that a little bit more, because my mind immediately went to all the sexual assault in the Catholic Church, for instance. And the statement that, well, we can expect that because they're just people, that really is a really uncomfortable assumption for me. They're not whole people. They're not completely formed people to do that, you know, and people who inflict other kinds of harm deliberately on other people. I just can't wrap my head around empathy and for those people. But I don't know where obviously you have to draw a line.
Yeah.
And where is it?
I mean, I think the thing that's been most helpful to me in that is where people have said, if you can remember that this person was once an infant, and you can picture them as the infant they were, it does not excuse anything that they've done. But what I know from the history of the world is that these things are going to happen. That doesn't make them right. It doesn't make them good. And it is horrible to have to figure out, okay, what do we do about it? How do we give consequences for it? Because there have to be consequences. I mean, saying that it's inevitable that it's going to happen. Somebody once said that we keep trying to create systems that are going to be so good that we don't have to be good, and that can't be done. We can't create systems that are so good that we don't have to be good. And people with power often violate that trust, and it's one of the reasons that I'm such a believer in grassroots power in as much democratization as possible, because give the power to the people who are going to suffer the consequences to the greatest degree, which, you know, I mean, one of the things you talk about, the hierarchy in the Catholic Church, is one of the things that makes abuse of power more possible. But abuse of power is possible anywhere, but it's more possible the more hierarchical things are, I think. So that's, I mean, that's a very inadequate way of beginning to answer what you're bringing up, but we could talk about that for hours, and I think maybe we need to wrap it up.
I apologize to a friend of mine at a get-together last night, and he said, I don't need an apology from you, and I said, no, I need to speak up, because he's trying to rob decency of being human from all of us, and somebody needs to speak up.
Thank you. Let's end with hymn number 1028 in the teal book, if you have that, or the words will also be up here, The Fire of Commitment. Please rise in body or spirit. With a benediction from Nancy MacDonald Ladd. And now, though sorrow and pain abide, let us gather what strength we have. What confidence and valor and faith, for we live to tell the story of our days, and in this telling, as in this weeping, we are not alone, but connected in mystery and wonder through the veil of our own pain to ourselves, to each other, and to all that remains holy, even in times such as these. May it be so.